Hi, buddy.
What's happening? Happy Thanksgiving. It's good to see you.
Well.
Oh, you got the Christmas stuff started early. I can see.
I do.
Oh, yeah. Boy.
The Christmas tree is up. The lights are on outside. I am still recovering from Thanksgiving. I ate so much that I actually started to sweat.
You got the meat sweats?
I did.
You sound proud of yourself.
Oh,
I did.
It was intentional.
Ham, turkey, all of it, like many different kinds of meat.
Come on, Tony. This is
shawarma.
The traditional New England Irish Catholic family. There's no ham. That's it would be sacrilegious, I think.
I wouldn't. Never been invited.
And that, no, and you shan't be.
So things will go on merrily as they have been.
I would love to have you at my Thanksgiving.
Please, it's not going to happen. I have things I've got to do. I've got my family traditions. I've got to support them. It's a little late in the game for new things to try.
We're too old to try new things. It should be the tagline of this podcast.
Plus, if there's no ham, I'm not coming.
Welcome to Rated Beat for Paranormal post-Thanksgiving break show. We took a week off. Thank you for your patience. We are back. I sound a little cruddy compared to what I usually do. I'm not down in Matty Road Studios. I'm upstairs. I'm having some work done down there. So for the next week or so, this will be how it sounds.
When Matty says down there, he means in the studio, in the basement. Sorry. Professionalism.
Yes. Decorum. Yes, so I hate USB mics. I don't like the sound. To the untrained ear, perhaps you don't notice difference, but to me and Tony, we notice the difference. But just bear with us. It's better than not doing a show, Tony. That might not be true.
We can only hope. Maybe we should do a poll on that, see how people actually respond. You know, you take a week off of this, people might realize how better off their life was before we showed up.
Yeah.
You take that risk.
Actually, that's a good rule around this house for me, too, is to I do better the less I speak.
Have you gotten into some kind of trouble that you'd like to talk about?
What day of the week is it?
Well, it's Tuesday, right? So yeah, it's early.
If I'm not in trouble, that would be the story.
I'm here for you. Let's talk about it. Unload. How's it going?
Great.
Anything paranormal related that happened to you over the break?
Well, it's funny. My dog, Rocky, started violently scratching at the wall next to my bed. Now, as you know, I have had some weird paranormal type of things happen upstairs. So one night, it's very unlike him too. At like 2-3 in the morning, he's just violently scratching his paws on this part of the wall next to my bed. I'm like, Rocky, because it's so unlike him. And he was just kind of pacing. And then then I yelled at him so much for the few nights in a row he was doing that. He was too scared to scratch at it. He knew not to scratch at it. He knew I'd yell at him and get, you know, move him away from there. So
right.
he just started laying in front of it and staring at the wall, which is really disturbing if you're into the paranormal, like to have a dog just stare at a corner. Do you know what I mean? Like he sees something.
Yeah, it's also strange that your dog would be so afraid and guilty of this that he would be quiet.
That's how I raised my son. What's the difference?
Yeah. Let's just keep going. So you had some people come over and check it out. You had an investigator come by.
Yeah, well, I think I've nailed it down to mice. I think
we're
a little bit of a mouse problem. So
okay.
He could hear and or smell whatever was going on in there. And so we've taken care of it. But that was disconcerting at 3 in the morning to have your dog like staring at a wall. Do you know what I mean?
Well, right. When you've heard ghostly footsteps in your house before.
Yes, exactly. How about you? Anything happened over Thanksgiving that is of note besides just having a wonderful time?
No, I had a great time of note. Supernaturally, no. Although I did, you know, there's a weird hill behind the house that I often see weird lights over.
Huh.
It's strange. And I know there's, you know, Westchester Airport's not too far away and there's plenty of air traffic, but I've seen a couple things up on that hill that were strange. And I saw something that was just a little too bright, a little too stationary, and in a place that wouldn't be.
And the fact that you are a, you're a multiple witness to things like that. You've had multiple sightings, I should say, is the best way to say it, or experiences. That makes it a little more significant, I think, than a normal person.
Than a normal person. Are you calling me? You said multiple when you started this conversation, and now I feel like you're saying that I am a multiple, and that if I were a normal person, I wouldn't be seeing this stuff. I'm a little thrown.
Abby normal.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of people who saw UFOs of note, John Lennon comes to mind. He had a UFO experience, and the Beatles documentary Get Back came out. I don't know if you got a chance to see that or you're aware of that.
I've seen a lot of Beatles stuff. Yeah, I've seen them in many things.
The reason I bring it up, I know you get annoyed when the Beatles come up. That's a that's them performing live, by the way, on Ed Sullivan Over My Shoulder, and that's all their records right there in my living room, as you can see. I'm a bit of an Anglophile and a Beatles maniac. But the reason I bring it up, it's not just because that movie came up, but because the person who curated and directed that Beatles documentary, Peter Jackson, is our director this week with The Frighteners. So it's kind of a cool little tie-in. He dropped that Beatles, I think it's 6-hour documentary, lost footage from the Get Back footage that they took back in the 60s. That was released over Thanksgiving Day break, Thanksgiving Day weekend. And so when we, it's kind of just a coincidence that Brian Kano, last week's guest, paranormal investigator Brian Kano, suggested The Frighteners to us. And I'm going, oh my gosh, it's a Peter Jackson film. Watching it on the weekend that I was watching Get Back. So kind of weird.
That is really cool. I wonder if Brian knew that when he suggested this.
Maybe. I went back and listened. He didn't mention it, but that could have been part of it.
That would have been really smart of him to do.
Yeah.
That would have been really smart. He's a smart guy, though. Beatles, not so much. I'll see it at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, he made a documentary about World War One. It was like refurbished footage from World War One that had never been seen before. I think it was World War One. That was apparently amazing. I haven't caught up with that yet.
Well,
World War One trumps the Beatles. I got to see the World War One thing.
What are you talking about?
We can talk. We'll do another show about this. We can do a whole other podcast just about this. And I think we should.
World War One. That was a blip in the radar compared to the cultural impact of the Beatles.
Okay. Can we talk about Rocky again then instead?
Rocky, come here. Rocky, you want to talk about Rocky? Come here, buddy. Come here. Oh, people can't see my dog.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, if you could all see my face, then the stories you'd have a story to tell. I have been, it's a strange and lonely place to be somebody who's not over the moon excited about the Beatles. And the thing is, like, I end up getting painted with this brush that, like, I'm a Beatles hater. And it's the same, you can't win. It's just like, unless you just accept them, into your heart wholesale as the greatest thing that ever happened, you're just no damn good. And I it's a lonely place to be. I just want to say, to have to suffer the onslaught of a kind of fandom that just never goes away. It's like Elvis, they stopped talking about Elvis. Can we talk about Elvis again? Like, let's talk about that.
Sure. I agree with everything.
Paranormal show. Elvis probably saw UFOs, though.
He did. And in fact, the night he was born, his dad and the doctor in attendance saw a blue light, boom, cascade over his house the moment he was born. And they basically had a UFO encounter the night Elvis was born. Isn't that incredible? A blue light cascaded over the house, over his little shack. Why are you laughing at me? That's
because I just, of course, somebody would create a Jesus myth about the birth of Elvis. No,
his father.
Of course they would. His father, what?
His father swore, and so did the doctor in attendance, that when he was born, why are you laughing at this? I think I need to remind you to go back and listen to a previous podcast I did called The Artist Alien Connection.
Okay. I don't mean to laugh, but clearly my intentions are <it's> meaningless.
Well, I don't know if it was a myth or not, but he swore to it. And so did the doctor.
Okay.
So, you know, if you believe that they, that the crazy talented, or at least some of the crazy talented artists among us have either are more prone to see these things, or maybe you have a connection, or maybe have.
You think that people that see lights over Elvis's house, that means Elvis is a hybrid, or that you really think he's a hybrid? I mean, what did he do for society? I mean, I love Elvis as much as anybody, but what did he do for society that would make aliens want to actually intervene here?
Well, it's what came first, the alien or the egg, because perhaps he was given this talent, or perhaps he was just different than the rest of us that made him so uber talented and appealing and incredible. And like, if you look at that 68 comeback special, he doesn't look human. He's like this leather clad god of some kind who just, you know, just a genius.
Give me a salt shaker of amphetamines and I won't look human either.
That was before that. The amphetamines ruined. No. Actually, that was right during the time.
It's not before it. It's before the amphetamines took a complete grip on his mind, but it's not true. Before the amphetamines.
True.
Nothing came before the amphetamines. Nothing.
Well, I think he got those in the army, as they say.
Yeah. I think they came over before. But look, we could talk about Elvis all day. We can. It's our podcast.
We're talking about him paranormally.
Mm.
And you know John's whole UFO sighting, don't you?
I actually don't know that I know this.
He saw a UFO in, I believe, in the daytime, broad daylight, New York City, said silently came almost eye level. You know, he was on the top of the Dakota or wherever he was. I don't know if he was actually at home in the Dakota because he was with his, you know, mistress, not Yoko, and Mr. Yoko's friend. Yeah, he was with her during
their
time together, and they both saw it. Mei Pang, I think her name was, and he swore to it. In fact, they both claimed missing time after the incident, and he put the lyric in his song, "There's UFOs over New York, and I ain't too surprised," based on his experience. And he always felt like he had some sort of. He felt like he said they, you know, I wanted to go with them. I wasn't scared. Like, I felt like there was a connection there type of thing. So, and there's a long list. It's kind of stunning, actually. So the question we asked on a podcast I did one time was, are these people just, you know, right brain dominant, the creative side of the brain? And so they're more open to these things, or is there some sort of connection where, like, some artists have claimed that they've received lyrics and information and music from an alien race?
For me, I'm the practical side kicks in, and I'm like, I think it probably has to do with airtime. Like, the only people that get interviewed about it are artists.
Mm. Mm.
And they're the only people that might be willing to talk about it. But that doesn't mean that, and I think it probably maybe has something to do with that. I mean, you know, who's interviewing, you know, a plumber from, for instance, Milwaukee about,
that's a good point,
what their experiences are. Not, I wonder if maybe that many,
but with the ratio of, if you, it just seems to be a high ratio per, like, if you take the amount of household names that we know, it's a pretty small number. And of that number, a lot of them claim to at least have experienced UFOs, but that could be true across society. I don't know.
Also all known drug takers. So I'm just saying. Like, exceptionally more than normal.
How dare you? All you actors take drugs. Oh, I saw your brother over Thanksgiving.
Speaking of drug-taking actors, what? Segway police, sir.
Well, I said all you actors. No, all right, minus the drug-taking part, although I don't know what he does and what he doesn't do.
He's a completely responsible human being.
Not Matthew. I was watching...
Oh.
Reruns over Thanksgiving of with my family. We're just kind of sitting around chilling and flicking around the TV, and Modern Family came on, and your brother, I guess it was Adam, was with Ed O'Neill playing his buddy who goes to a LA Kings hockey game with him in a Modern Family episode. They become friends in the episode. So I was like, hey, that's Tony's brother.
Look, you know, this is a sad thing because I don't even know what you're talking about. This is how close we are as brothers.
Understood.
It's all on the show. It looks like we're great friends, but we'd have no idea what television shows we're on. We had no idea.
Well, it's not even, yeah, it's nothing to do with your lack of closeness as a brother. You don't even know what I'm talking about television wise. You have no conception of what show
I haven't heard of that. Are you, is this a weekly show? Is this a documentary? I don't know what you're talking about.
So I stood up and yelled, "That's Tony's brother. And Elvis was part hybrid alien." And nobody listened to me.
But now you don't know which part of that made no one listen to you.
By the way, if we did retain some audience from last week's Brian Kano episode, I think we just lost them.
We've certainly been hitting home runs on this supernatural front. This is some scintillating conversation about the paranormal and about movies. It's been a different kind of intro this week.
All right, so Peter Jackson, Get Back, The Beatles, but let's look at his movie, The Frighteners, because that's what we came here to do, Tony. Tony, once an architect, Frank Bannister, played by Michael J. Fox, now passes himself off as an exorcist of evil spirits. But what he does not count on is more people dying in the small town where he lives. As he tries to piece together the supernatural mystery of these killings, he falls in love with the wife of one of the victims and deals with a crazy FBI agent. Tony, this is 1996's The Frighteners, directed, as I said, by Peter Jackson. Did you know anything about this movie, or did you remember it at all when Brian recommended it to us?
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it when it came out.
Did you have any memory of it?
I remember, yes, I had some memory. Some of it was still pretty clear, and yeah. I'd forgotten probably half of it, but there were things I remembered. I'll be honest, I didn't love it when I first saw it.
Yeah.
I remember being maybe a little disappointed, but like a lot of things, you know, my tastes change and my opinions about stuff will change over. I mean, this came out in 96, so, you know. And I hadn't seen it since, and I think any movie by a reputable director is worth watching more than once to get the nuance. And so I was excited to see it again. Had you watched it?
I remember it exists.
And you're a Michael J. Fox fan, admittedly.
I am. And boy, let me tell you something. No matter what we say about this movie, no matter what we think about it, I was so glad I watched it just because it is a time capsule, like capturing, in my opinion, anyway, how charismatic and great and handsome Michael J. Fox was. I forgot how handsome he was. I don't know why that struck me so much, but maybe because he's got a short haircut in this film. He's got a cropped haircut, like he's some sort of, I don't know, like a detective. He looks more like a detective. And I'm like, man, I just like had such a man crush on Michael J. Fox in this movie based on his performance and his, I'm like, he looks fantastic. And what it was a little bittersweet because it also is the last major film role he ever did before his Parkinson's diagnosis. So I was just really, I don't know. I just was so struck watching him.
Yeah. I mean, it really is something. It was his last movie, I guess, or his big last leading big movie.
Yeah.
And, you can kind of see it in his body. Like I didn't really notice it at the time. It was an amazing thing about Michael J. Fox and how he managed that illness through some of the acting before anybody knew that he was sick.
Yeah.
And there's a certain kind of like twitchiness and way that he'd move that he incorporated some of this into the performance, which was really amazing. Like that was pretty incredible to see.
Yes, especially when he exits and enters rooms, or walks away from someone. He kind of moves his shoulders and ducks away.
Yeah,
tell he's trying to just walk through the.
But he always had a really interesting way of moving. It used to be a lot more athletic, but then like with this thing, you could see him like really working out how he was gonna kind of incorporate some of these things that he couldn't help. You know, his body kind of was betraying him, I guess, a little bit at this point. Yeah. Just enough to be like, oh, I can see him working with that, but it didn't detract from the part, and it doesn't look like that's what's going on unless you kind of analyze it.
Absolutely.
So that was really cool. And I mean it seems like you were in like Karate Kid idolization thing with Michael J. Fox a little bit, like that you really like Michael J. Fox. Like I like him too. I just think that, you know, the 15 years on you that I have put me a little past Family Ties when it was so popular. And I'm not that much older. I'm kidding. I'm not. I'm only not really.
Oh, by the way, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It was Tony's birthday this past week. And I text him happy 38th.
And that is the new normal for me. That's a lot better than the reality that I'm faced with.
38th.
But anyway, you were Michael J. Fox. I mean, you're Michael J. Fox apologist, probably, actually.
No, I don't know, because I don't give him, unfortunately, much thought anymore. But that's why I say this really struck me of like, boy, he really had it. And when you talk about now, I have a theory about this movie. I have a weird theory about this movie. Okay, so when you talk about like him replacing Eric Stoltz in Back to the Future, I recently watched a documentary, The Movies That Made Us, or one of the
documentaries. Just saw that too.
Yeah, about Back to the Future. And you see like, and they all talk about it, Zemeckis, everybody, like the day one he came on that set, it was like, oh my God, we have a movie. Like he's that good. He's that electric. He's that charismatic. He's that likable. And you see it in this movie. So I kept thinking about that too. And then my theory about this movie is there's a scene when they flash back to Michael J. Fox before we meet him in this movie, when he was an architect, before he becomes the Ghostbuster guy, the psychic detective guy, he's an architect. And they flash back to that time in the movie. And he's got like long reddish hair.
He looks like Dana Carvey.
Well, he looks, yes, he does. And he looks bizarrely like Eric Stoltz.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Eric Stoltz had long hair. And I'm going, this is a shot at Eric Stoltz that they're doing.
Well, if that's a shot, you know, like, look, I'm gonna put a little stake in the ground here for my boy Eric Stoltz.
Yeah.
I don't know what a person has to do to just avoid being humiliated by a scenario that they had nothing to do with, that they were simply abused by a system and spat out. And 30 years later, we're still making fun of him for it. And I actually really I enjoy that Movies That Made Us show kind of,
right?
That move really pissed me off. And I got angry at the show.
What move?
Using Eric Stoltz and his performance and whatever as the brunt of the brunt of a joke, about how great Michael J. Fox. It's like talking about the Beatles at a certain point to me. It's like, Michael J. Fox is great. That doesn't mean we have to crap on Eric Stoltz because he got fired.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to rewatch it. I wasn't focusing on that as a joke, or I didn't take it so much as a joke. It's more, I think people are fascinated by the fact that such a huge role, like that rarely happens that we know about in public, that like such a huge role of a huge movie, you just replace the actor after all that shooting. I think it's more that than people like, hey, let's rag on Eric Stoltz for 30 years. Like, although there probably is that element, I'm just not aware of that.
I'm like, if that were me, I'd be furious. Oh. Like I got fired. How much? Okay. Leave it alone.
He was awesome in Pulp Fiction, by the way.
He's great in Pulp Fiction. He's great in Mask. Here's what I would like to do. I would like to impose every time people say, oh, how great it is that Eric Stoltz got fired, we all have to say how great it is that Michael J. Fox wasn't in Mask, because that would have sucked.
Agreed.
You seem a little unenthusiastic about this, but I was excited, but you don't seem to.
About
Michael, my mandate, my thing about like we have to support Eric by saying,
well, no, I just,
every time it comes up, you know, at least Michael J. Fox wasn't in Mask.
That's news to me that people like are ridiculing him. I didn't take it as a ridicule. I took it as like, holy shit, this huge role after shooting all this, they replaced this actor. Like that never happens. It was less about Eric Stoltz. But then when I saw Michael J. Fox look like Eric Stoltz in the movie, I thought, I wonder if Zemeckis was like, because it's weird. Maybe. I actually thought it was Eric Stoltz for a second. It's weird.
That is weird. Maybe Zemeckis did. Maybe he held a grudge or something. I don't know.
And probably didn't even tell Michael J. Fox. No, I'm all for it. I support. If it was me, I'd probably be on a press tour saying like, hey, I took this role seriously, this Back to the Future role seriously, and they hired me. Screw them, you know?
Exactly.
I feel for him. Definitely.
Well, you know, I think the big reason why. my Michael J. Fox, like, why it worked was because he came off of shooting Family Ties for, you know, for the whole day, and then would shoot Back to the Future at night, and he never slept. But that's exhausting. He wasn't good because he was exhausted, but I think he was just acting all the time. He had no filter. Like, I think he was just completely easy in front of the camera because he was always in front of the camera, like every moment of his life for years.
That's a great point. I know that the best work I do is when I don't have long layoffs, you know, and in anything, whether it's this or
on camera. I've never experienced that myself, so I'm looking forward to getting a nice run on the whole acting thing. That would be fun.
The length of a layoff is very relative, Tony. For some people,
yes,
our El Guapo is a week. For other people, our El Guapo is a big scary man named El Guapo. So let's get into this film. It is a wild kind of mess, but I kind of don't know what to make of this movie. I'm so torn. There's a lot about it that I think I hated, and there's a lot about it that I think I loved. And I don't know that I've been this perplexed by a movie since we've been doing this. I've seen terrible movies doing this podcast with you with great performances. I've seen great performances wasted, and we have. I've seen what I thought were really good films with some wonky things going on with the direction of the actors and the sets and the special effects, and was kind of disappointed on that end. So this one, though, stands above all of them in terms of so much is happening in this movie. So many action set pieces and CGI and effects and great performances and weird performances and kind of bad performances here and there. It is just this, I'm still processing it days later.
Well, when you process something, let me know how it comes out. Cause I kind of gave up trying to process it a little bit during somewhere in the middle of the movie.
It lost you, did it? It's long.
Here's the thing. I think, you know, I honestly want to see them remake this with a better hand on the comedy. My biggest complaint really about it is that it's really trying hard to make me laugh, and it's failing like a lot. Like, most of the time, the jokes aren't really working for me. The performances aren't loose. They don't feel like comfortable. No one's in a comfortable comedic pocket with any of it. And they made some technical decisions to shoot it in certain ways that I think helped make that problem worse. Is the idea great? Absolutely. I think the concept for this is probably one of the more genius, like, high concept, you know, comedy horror movie ideas around. It's so smart. I love the idea of Michael J. Fox's character, a down and out con artist who's actually psychic and can see ghosts, but is using it to con people. I thought was fantastic.
That's the conceit that makes it so different and special, is that he is conning people, but he's not pretending to see that he has ghosts, and he's using the ghosts to trick people into thinking the house is haunted and then clearing the house.
Which
is brilliant.
Cause he's friends with the ghosts and he can get them out of the house or send them into the house and they do what he says. I mean, I think the movie gets really bogged down in its own mythology, and it tries to take on a lot of different things and avenues that, like the Jeffrey Combs character, the FBI agent, you know, I mean, well, we can talk about some of these performances, but just as a construct, like the idea of this character, it's like, okay, but they don't have enough time to make him really work as a character, because they're on to all these other ideas, and there's a serial killer, and then there's a Grim Reaper, and then there's just so many layers to it. I don't know that they did themselves any favors by having it be quite that complicated.
Yeah, every new act, you know, there seems to be like 100 acts in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, like, not three main acts. It's like, there's like act 2A and 2B and 2C and 2-3. And then we meet this character. And his character, I could do a separate podcast just on him and that performance in that movie and whatever happened to this actor. And I know he played Reanimator, but what's his name again?
Jeffrey Combs or Coombs.
Yes. He comes on the scene maybe a little more than midway through the movie, as this FBI agent with this kind of like 1920s style weird haircut, greased down, almost Hitler-esque haircut, if you will, like this weird bowl cut.
Hitler right on the money.
Yeah, and long black trench coat, and he's just this bizarre character that gets physically ill when a woman yells at him, and he's backing away and hiding behind corners. And, you know, at one point he's interviewing Michael J. Fox or interrogating him, and he's delivering dialogue, and then he sits in the chair and immediately gets back up again and walks away and walks in. And just like, this character is so bizarre and yes, funny, but so hard to make anything out of, like you said, because it's just, he's gone again. And it's mixed in with this mythology about the serial killer and Dee Wallace's character, who we'll talk about in a second. So all these layers, and Michael J. Fox's wife who was killed.
That backstory of things. How Michael J. Fox was responsible for her death in a car accident. It was an accident, but like he was driving, and that history, and then how she's then tied into the Grim Reaper mythology, which is coming back to haunt this town. But a serial killer who's dead is now impersonating the Grim Reaper. I mean, there's a billion angles on it, and I don't even necessarily mind that. I just think that they didn't rein it in. They didn't have control over it somehow, because I think about, like, we saw something that reminded me of this movie a little bit. It was a comedy horror movie, newer, Netflix-esque, hysterical guy that we love who was in Will Forte's movie, that movie.
Extraordinary,
right. That had similarly complicated plot lines and mythologies, and you know, it really did seem as jam-packed with stuff and gags and characters.
Yeah.
And that movie, I thought, had a much better handle on it, had like control over it in a way that this felt like it was always a football that was kind of fumbling out of their hands that they were trying to keep in the air.
Yes. So I feel like it's a great comparison, because they're both horror comedy. They're both kind of gonzo horror comedy.
Broad, really broad.
But I feel like Extraordinary got small and charactery when it needed to. And this movie went broader, less character-y, and more into, as you said, mythology and special effects. I mean, Extraordinary is very restrained in the special effects. A lot of them are practical. A lot of them are up close, or as you would say, in camera. And this thing was just like, so the ghosts in this movie that you spend most of the time talking to are either CGI, or they're just matte, like, you know, think of the ghosts in the haunted house that you see.
It's like the Disney. Exactly. It's exactly what I thought. They look like that. Which was not a bad idea.
Right. I forgave it because it all, in a way, it made it simpler. You go, okay, this is what we're dealing with. Now let's just hear what the characters have to say.
I just think that we love about Ghostbusters is that it's like Saturday Night Live have this weird, like, stepchild that went off and just did whatever it wanted to do. And the comic minds were all kind of like really sparking off of each other. Mm. Ghostbusters is the closest relative to this movie I can think of, really, you know, in terms of its tone and the broadness of the comedy and everything. But
and some of the ghosts look the same, actually.
Similar, exactly.
Same technology, yeah.
But it's just about the characters. It's about human interaction missing. Like none of this is motivated by anything logical or real. None of the characters act in a way that's anything but, boy, it'd be funny if they did this. And, oh, wouldn't it be funny if they did that? Or if that happened. But it's always, the choices are always like counter to what they're trying to set up about a character. For instance, Trini Alvarado goes to dinner like 2 days after her husband dies with Michael J. Fox. Now, her husband's a jerk, right. Like a jerk, to the point where I don't like her anymore because she's married to this guy.
Why are you with him? Yeah.
And then she goes to dinner and is like over it. Isn't even thinking about him
flirting
as a
with
dead
Michael
person.
J. Fox.
And it's not, didn't feel on purpose. It just felt unthought about because they were worried about the ghosts working or something. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of that in this movie. There's a lot of kind of inexplicable actions taken by characters. One of the things I did love about it were again, the performances. And like Dee Wallace
Well, yeah, she's great, man. I would her the end stuff with her and that shotgun, fantastic.
Oh, she goes from what you think is a cloistered, abused shut-in, and then the next scene you see her and she's weeping and broken because she was the quote-unquote victim of the serial killer. And then when you meet her again in the third act, she was in on it, spoiler alert, on a 30-year-old movie, and she's like this cold-blooded killer. I'm like, she could have been nominated for an Academy Award for this performance, and I'm not being facetious. Like, she plays so many notes in this movie, and she's so terrifying when she needs to be and so heartbreaking when she needs to be. Dee Wallace, underrated. We've said it before on this podcast. Criminally underrated.
She was fantastic. She still is. I love Dee Wallace. Oh. Love her. She was my well, you know, that's tough. Jo Beth Williams was a pretty great Spielberg mom too, but Dee Wallace was, I think, the absolute perfect example of a Spielberg mom.
Yeah.
And then she went on and did like The Howling, which we covered.
Yeah, we did.
Pretty different. She had a lot of range. She was great.
Sure.
So this is kind of like Spielberg tapping Toby Hooper to do Poltergeist. You know, Peter Jackson hadn't done Lord of the Rings at this point. Peter Jackson was known for like Sam Raimi level, crazy violent, super insanely violent, cartoonish comedy horror movies that were all about like the most gore you've ever seen. So Peter Jackson's early movies were gorier than Evil Dead movies, but they were also really low budget. And a lot of the thrill of those movies is the extreme violence, which is cartoonish and funny, but it's really extreme. Mm. The incredibly bad taste on display. And he made a movie called Bad Taste, which is really offensive. There's none of that here. And I'm like, why are you getting Peter Jackson to clean up his act so much that now we've just got all the, you know, gags of a Peter Jackson movie and the high end effects integration into the plot? But you're not, there's no gore here at all. There's none of that visceral anarchic kind of like naughty schoolboy thing that he had going for him in every other movie. And I missed it so much here. I'm like, that guy should have showed up. I don't know why he didn't show up, but I think everybody was a little scared of like making a Hollywood movie, which this was.
And it's a huge mistake that we make with musicians and filmmakers and everything, is that you try to homogenize what makes an artist special. So you mentioned his naughtiness in his previous films. There's elements of it in this movie, but they're like half measured and they're stripped down and they're not fully explored. So like when the old ghost humps the mummy.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's that all comes off key. As
nothing but off key and disturbing.
Yeah. In the wrong way.
So it's like, if they had just gone with that and the old ghost was a horn dog and trying to, you know, do things with the mummies, that would have been wonderful. But instead, they tried to half measure it. It's like, well, we got to get this rating. We got to make money. We got to appeal to everyone. So
totally agree with you.
Right. It comes off as horrible.
Totally agree with you. So I guess what I'm saying is that I would line up tomorrow and pay top dollar to go see this movie directed by a young Peter Jackson, maybe without Zemeckis' influence, like maybe without that Hollywood, because Zemeckis, you know, I all respect, you know, never been one of my favorite directors. I like some stuff just fine, and some of his movies I think are great. But I mean, overall, I don't walk away from his movies going, man, does he have a way with actors? Or like, oh, or wow, that script, you know, that's so interesting. It's very kind of watered down to me a little bit. And I get it. They're trying to recapture the lightning of Back to the Future, which who could do that, really?
Yeah.
I mean, Zemeckis hasn't really ever been able to really do that. And then the other thing is that I feel like this is right before Peter Jackson made Lord of the Rings. Like, this is the first thing the last thing he made that was kind of a, you know, an attempt to make Hollywood happy, maybe. Before that, he'd only done one other movie that was kind of serious minded, and it's called Heavenly Creatures, and it's great. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No.
Psychological thriller with fantastical overtones. It's a great movie. And I don't know, with this one, I just felt like they were trying to try not, like you said, like get past the ratings board, be cool with Hollywood and make a movie for everybody. And this is, this shouldn't have been to me.
Agreed. Did you have favorite moments or lines or anything that stood out to you? We talked about the performances, which, you know, in this kind of jumbled mess, there's some wonderful performances and weird, quirky performances.
There's great moments from people, but I don't know if there's, to me, a great through line performance. I think that's where that's my problem. Like the characters never really are true to themselves. They do what's needed for the movie to be funny, but not for what's true to them all the time. And so I don't know. I don't know if I love any of the performances. I think there's some really funny moments. Like Jeffrey Combs is a great example. He came to play. Like he's a really extreme actor. He's cartoonish. You know, he's known for really big performances in other horror comedies like Reanimator and From Beyond. And he's great in those movies, but they're also very campy movies. And they're very kind of like B movies where this is afraid to do that. This movie's afraid to be what would make Jeffrey Combs work. And I don't know that it's his fault that that didn't happen or.
No,
I don't think so.
Tonally, this movie wanted to be a couple different things, and you've hit on another great point that I noticed is like, it's way over the top, cartoonish broad performances by like the girl's boyfriend, things like that, and then at the same time there are these really kind of nuanced moments. So tonally, it doesn't commit to any one thing. And I don't think that was a choice, put it that way. I'm not convinced that that was like, hey, let's make this art house movie that's all kinds of different styles. You know, I just think they, you know, threw scenes against the wall to some extent. Well,
so, also, they were dealing with, you know, I think they were pushing the envelope with some of the CGI and some, the effects, you know, which Zemeckis always did. He still does. Like, he's always pushing technology forward in his movies. And Peter Jackson too. So I'm sure, I know they had CGI before this, but you know, I think they were trying to do more of it and do more things with it than you usually saw. And I remember being impressed by it at the time when it came out, like being, wow, that's really, look what they're able to do. But that stuff, you know, if it's not a practical effect that's well shot, it ends up being dated in 10 years, no matter what. Yeah, and so the effects are kind of dated here. And then so it's like they spent all this time and energy making the scenes work, integrating these effects. But then when the effects don't pop anymore, you're like, well, why don't they just have an actor in the room and play that as a person? And then at least the scenes would work with these actors. But all the choices of the ghosts to be, I mean, those actors were on a soundstage somewhere and probably never met Michael J. Fox, you know?
The scariest moment to me in the film was actually one that was kind of, and this is very indicative of the problem, a lot of the problems with it, is like the scariest moment for the film to me, I think, was he was trying to play as kind of broad camp in a way. When you look at how it's presented, it's basically a flashback through a news piece, and it's kind of parodying like Inside Edition newsreel of these murders that happened. And Jake Busey, who's awesome as this serial killer, you're doing a flashback of this serial killer and how he killed people in the hospital. And he's absolutely chilling in that scene. I thought like that came off as totally disturbing and spooky and scary.
Are you talking about that black and white recreation stuff? Yes, oh, that was great. You know, that was amazing. The black and white like stuff that looks like it's from the late 60s. Yeah, in the beginning.
It's almost like and they're parodying kind of like a heavy hitting news thing of the time.
This movie. It's kind of like a Natural Born Killers quality to
it. Yes, exactly. And I thought, oh, okay, is this kind of what this movie is going to be? Like almost like a Natural Born Killers type of thing. And then it's quickly not again. It becomes Disney again, and there's organ music. And so it's just a lot to take in your senses.
I'm also confused by Michael J. Fox's character here. I think there was a bit of a misstep. I don't know. He's charming and he's great. I love watching him. But the construction of this character, I guess it's typified by the fact that we meet him and he's a down and out guy. He's hustling. He's like handing out cards, paranormal investigation cards at funerals, you know, at grave sites. And he's getting kicked out of like grave sites and barred from cemeteries because he's just a lowlife. Okay, that's a fascinating character. He also, we discover, is a very irresponsible driver and drives. He's a bad driver. He's described as a bad driver. But when we see him drive, he's actually an aggressively evil driver.
Right.
So that's different.
Going over medians and yes.
Cutting corners, doing whatever he wants to do. And then one of the first things that happens in the movie is he crashes through a picket fence into somebody's front yard and crushes their like little gnome garden.
Yeah, on purpose.
On purpose or just because he's careless or whatever,
on the way out after the argument, he does it on purpose.
So, but even before then, when the gentleman comes out of the house, whose gnome garden he's just destroyed, and it turns out to be a character we'll get to know later, Trini Alvarado's husband, we don't know that at the time, this is how they meet. He's upset that somebody drove through their yard and destroyed their front yard. And we're supposed to, and the filmmakers are acting like we're supposed to think he's an asshole.
Right. And he is also,
to me was the kind of move where I'm like, and we're supposed to just kind of like Michael J. Fox's character because it's Michael J. Fox, but he's an aggressively arrogant, mean-spirited person that we meet. And then we're told he's that way because his wife died and he's sad. Well, track this. She's dead because of his bad driving.
Right.
And all her death has taught him is how to be a more aggressive driver. You've not set up a character that I want to see succeed or care whether he gets through this movie or not.
It's bizarre.
And
the only thing I quibble with you is that I don't think that there's a couple bad performances in this movie, but I don't think that he was one of them. I don't think there are many bad performances. I think there's great performances.
Well,
is there crappy, weird, bizarre character development and bad writing?
But I mean, whose job is that then? I mean, if that's the character. I mean, that's a whole construction of the character. They're like,
there wasn't a moment I didn't believe Michael J. Fox as an actor, like his performance in terms of that. There are things he does that make no sense, but I mean, you can't, at the end of the day, that I've lobbied for things to directors and they've said like, yeah, this is what the script is. You know what I mean?
Right. So we can argue about that. We can argue about the fact that a star of his magnitude might have some pull over the certain writing of certain scenes or certain things, or might have found a way to modulate his performance to be likable enough to understand. I mean, it comes down to casting in a certain respect. Maybe to me, it would have been made more sense if it was a Bill Murray type of person who I enjoy watching being that negative slob. I get it. I enjoy it. There's something about it that comments on society. When Michael J. Fox does it, it seems out of character and it just seems like he's a bad guy and hasn't learned something and won't. And I don't know whose fault that is. If that's Michael J. Fox's fault or the writers or maybe mine for not being able to just enjoy a movie for once.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's extraordinary what he does because of what you've described here. And list is like that I was even rooting for him in any way. It was confusing and muddled, but I just find he's so charming.
All right. You got a crush on him. I get it. You got a man crush on him.
He's like, how am I rooting for this guy against Jake Busey? Like, there's no, I don't even know what he's doing.
Somehow
you do. That lead, that girl is also, whatever happened to her? I mean, Trini Alvarado is so good in this.
I cannot agree with you, and it breaks my heart because I think Trini Alvarado is great and I love her. I was so excited to see her show up. And then I'm like, would somebody that knows how to direct a scene with actors please just show up? There's just talking at a dinner table and it doesn't track. Like, it just doesn't track emotionally. And so you and I can, we're going to disagree on that a little bit.
Well, I'll agree with you what you're saying, but I just don't blame them. Like, I think their performances are great. I just think they're asked to do something that's preposterous. Like, what woman would be and why am I rooting for? And all those questions are different than that's a false performance. That's not believable. She's not good. Like, I think these performances are great. Now, there are actors in this movie who play so broad, and I thought maybe that's where he was going, and it doesn't fit with those performances. Like, the dude whose fence gets broken, his performance tonally is wildly different than, like, Dee Wallace and Michael J. Fox and Trini Alvarado. So it's this mismatch of styles, and even the two ghost friends he's got, those performances are so broad, so silly, so parody almost, that it just doesn't fit with really – at times nuanced and powerful performances. What Dee Wallace does when she's in her broken phase, crying to Trini Alvarado, like, I was fooled by this guy, I just wanted to love him. Like, that is a powerful, if you just took that scene and put it in another movie, you're like, oh my God, that's a great piece of acting, but it's in this mess. I mean, maybe we're talking about apples and oranges. I don't know.
We are, I guess it comes in like, how do you define a great performance? I mean, like you're describing great effort. You're describing really talented, brilliant actors who are, I think, unable to give great performances because they're being hampered by bad writing and direction that doesn't make a lot of sense. I don't know if it can count as great if it's not on the screen. Like, if the whole thing isn't on the screen, I don't blame them. And this is what I'm saying. I actually think Trini Alvarado is a completely underappreciated actor from that time. I've always thought she was great. I'm always surprised when I see actors who I have a lot of appreciation for, who for whatever reason aren't at their best in a movie. And I'm just always get curious as to why. And so I'm not blaming her. I just think that the sad part is she was restricted from giving a great performance because of certain things that were in her way.
It's so perplexing because I thought this movie was aware of itself at certain times and then unaware of itself. You know, I thought it was being and then quickly lost its way. Like, she has, I'll give you an example of that. She's with this jerk who ends up dying, this husband, and she's describing to him before he dies something that happened to another woman, this Dee Wallace character. And she kind of wistfully goes, she just fell for the wrong guy. It could happen to anyone. And then he's just being this douchebag right at the end of the bed, right? And you're like, that's so brilliant. Like, it could happen to anyone. And I go, all right, this movie is smart and it's aware of itself. Yeah. And then it doesn't do that most of the time.
Think about, like, I'm trying to think of movies we've referenced on here. Like, if it had the kind of tone that Gross Point Blank had, or you mentioned, like, you know, these two of my dad's movies, like So I Married an Axe Murderer, which are perverse and ahead of the audience, and not, you know, it feels like they were trying to make sure little kids were going to have a good time here too. Why? I don't need little kids.
It has those moments. It has axe murderer type of moments and smart moments and funny moments,
It's undercut by wanting a bigger audience. And I'm like, you've just lost audience because of that move. That's not going to get you a bigger audience. And it was true. This movie did not take over the world. I don't remember it as being a hugely successful thing, but I really was, you know, I get why Brian Kano wanted us to see it and recommend it as somebody who, you know, appreciates Ghostbusters. This is a fascinating kind of like comparison to that movie. And why does that movie work for me? Like, gangbusters for the most part. And this one stalls out.
I can tell you one of the reasons he recommended it. And I haven't spoken to him, but one of the things I made a note of is this movie, it's not going to be, but this movie could be one of those movies that we didn't pass as a film, but that might pass on the paranormal score alone, because this movie is chock full at different times with paranormal terminology.
Yeah.
Right. With psychology in terms of paranormal, it looks into a lot of different aspects of how people go about demonology, poltergeist. It references term after term after term at different points. Even the detective character, who's this wacky, the FBI character, who's this wacky character, gets into some stuff about telekinesis and things. So on the paranormal score, and just the fact that Michael J. Fox's character is tricking people using actual ghosts, there's a lot here paranormally that's really interesting.
True. And that surprised me a lot, actually. How they talked about, you know, the ghosts, them being made out of a plasma or that substance that actually has some physical property to it. So you can kind of damage them, but they reconstitute themselves. Yes. That was funny, you know?
Yes.
I loved until he turned into a creepy, like, mummy molester. I mean, that was the weirdest thing in the world, but that old prospector character was really great. I mean, to me, that concept sold what they were trying to do with these ghosts more than the other two did. Yeah, that the other ghost, I loved. And I thought the actor playing him totally got how to do that part. And it was kind of delightful every time he showed up until that creepy mummy scene where I don't even want to remember it. There's one shot in it where you're just like, really? We're really, because they've established this is for children, this movie. They really have.
Yeah, exactly. He was, the other two ghosts made me just straight up uncomfortable, I'll be honest, for a bunch of different reasons that I don't want to get into now. But there's some weird stuff about those characters that made me uncomfortable. And that whole set piece, that whole scene with the police shooting at him, and like every action in that scene rang false to me. From the way they were firing at him, this unarmed man, to what he does to distract them, to people's actions and activities in that room, in that museum. I'm like, is he going for parody camp here? Or as you said, is it more about he wanted to make this ghost scene work and so everything else be damned?
Yeah.
Realistic activity be damned.
Yeah. Part of me felt like I got a real strong, like early Tim Burton vibe too. And I was like, were they trying to kind of make a Tim Burton movie? And in a way, I feel like they might have been trying to make a Tim Burton movie.
It's a lot of parallels.
And at that period, like if you don't remember 90s and late 80s Tim Burton, like if you're a little young to remember that and you only remember the latest crop of last 10 or 15 years of Tim Burton, you don't really remember the edge that he had and how he was doing things with fantasy movies and stuff that were blowing people's minds, that changed the rules on a lot of stuff. And his ability to know comedy and like understand comedy pacing and rhythm and tone, and incorporate a lot of elaborate effects, I think is kind of almost unparalleled. Like, I don't think anybody could really do it as good as him. And maybe they just tried for it and they just couldn't make that part of it work. It's a fun, crazy ride. You do kind of see a lot of things whizzing by. It feels like you're on a Disney ride. It really does actually feel like you're on a trolley going through, you know, some miniaturized little horror world. And there's a lot of fun to be had in that. And I get wanting to make a movie like that.
Had this movie been as successful as Ghostbusters, there'd be a ride at Disney right now where you'd be in Michael J. Fox's car.
100%.
Drive all crazy places. You'd see those three ghosts.
Yeah.
Mr.
Toad's Wild Ride, but Frighteners. Yeah, absolutely. I can completely see that.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of what they maybe were hoping for. And why some of the problems that exist.
You know, I mean, I can see Zemeckis really clearly thinking they had something huge and knowing that Peter Jackson was already a director that was doing very effects heavy stuff at a budget, like able to do amazing things in camera for little, like not as much money. They shot in New Zealand, clearly. And that makes for a strange choice in a way too. Like, I was like, why don't you just make this New Zealand? It was driving me crazy when people used to do that. They used to like think that American audiences just would go crazy if there was set in another country.
Right. Like, who cares?
And clearly shooting in another country.
Beautiful town. But it didn't quite look like the Pacific Northwest. It certainly didn't look like Maine or anything like that. Cause the houses have that Australian kind of ranch style.
Yeah.
Everything's for hot weather. So it just comes off like a set almost.
Yeah. And I, you know what, now that we're mentioning this, I just figured it's out something possible. Peter Jackson was making an American style movie written probably by Americans in his hometown, which is known for its own kind of humor. New Zealand has its own, you know, kind of humor identity. You can see it in their movies. Mm-hmm. You can see it in Peter Jackson's early movies. And I don't think he felt comfortable actually accessing that in this movie. And I think if he had, this movie really would have completely worked for me.
Mm. Yeah.
It's almost like they cut him off at the knees and made him make Goonies when he really wanted to make, you know, one of these crazier, like risky, edgier movies that they make in New Zealand and Australia too. But
and then the production said, we've got a paranormal version of Back to the Future here.
Let's just cleaned it up a little maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But
all right. Well, at the end of the day, Tony, are you rating this P for paranormal or P for pass?
I'm going to pass. I'm going to pass. Yeah, I mean, I get you. I you know, it is well researched. I think oddly, it has a lot of really valid stuff in it. But for me to watch a movie about a paranormal investigator and at no point for me to want to become a paranormal investigator, you've made a mistake somewhere for me, and I can't.
I'm gonna give it a P for pass too, begrudgingly, because I think that, you know, it would be worth it just to see Dee Wallace do her thing, see Michael J. Fox do his thing, even though we slightly disagree on that. And the other actors do their things, that bizarre performance, as we talked about, that interestingly bizarre and funny performance, quirky performance by the FBI agent. But at 2 hours,
it's long.
I just feel like it's a bit of a slog to go through that, to see those points, watch Dee Wallace in any, pretty much
in any number of things.
Yeah. And same with Michael J. Fox.
You also have to deal with the fact that you've got a movie that has Melanie Lynskey in it, and in which she has no lines, and that's too frustrating. I'm not okay with that.
Yeah. I must say, and kind of, I was fascinated by this movie. I started off by saying I was perplexed by it, and so I did a little reading about it. It does have right now a cult following.
I'm not surprised.
A pretty big and growing cult following, and not to justify, this is not why I bring this up. But one of the main reasons is people say that this movie has, like, if you scroll Rotten Tomatoes and the fan reaction, which is like, I think it's, I was surprised by how high it was, like 70% or something. They say these kind of hidden performances, these hidden gem performances within this kind of big bombastic mess have been lost to history. So if you check it out for that maybe.
Well, you know, all the people that have loved the Lord of the Rings movies are going back to the catalog and seeing, you know, forgotten movies of his. And nobody's talking really about The Frighteners much, I guess. Right. So it's cool that movies like this have a life and people want to be fans and get something out of it. That's awesome.
At the end of the day, I'm glad I watched it because it was a wild ride. It was a wild ride.
I'm not going to put it on my shelf.
Okay. Me neither. We agree on this. Next week, a very exciting and special episode. We've been waiting for this for a long time. Some of us longer than others.
Some of us longer than others, yeah.
Some of us more desperately than others. But my partner, the great Anthony Arkin, his writing, directing, co-writing and directing masterpiece, Sender, has been released. You can get it now anywhere you stream movies, pretty much, from Amazon Prime, right, Tony, to Hulu.
Right now it is on Amazon. It hasn't hit Amazon Prime yet. It should hit Amazon Prime in March, but it's on Amazon, meaning it's for rent right now on Amazon.
Got it.
But if you have Prime, you'll be able to see it with bundled in that Prime and in March. And it's on Vimeo and Vudu. And a few other places that I forget right now, but you can look it up.
Look up Sender. Make sure it's directed by Anthony Arkin. There's a couple movies with The Sender.
There's The Sender. Yeah. And there's a short film called Sender. But this is the only full-length major motion picture called Sender that I am involved in.
So we are going to have a very special guest, Michael King, who is Tony's writing and production partner on this film.
Yep.
And I have a little small part in it. So we are going to review Tony's movie, Sender. Oh, we're going to review goodness. Our own movie. So I expect you to sit there
quietly. That's against the rules, but we're going to do it.
I expect you to sit there quietly while I do an hour on my performance.
It could be a whole podcast unto itself, your performance. It is not a part that lasts very long on screen time or has a lot of language in it. But Maddie makes more of this than you could possibly imagine.
Let's just say I pack a punch.
You certainly do.
So I can't wait to do this. This is going to be a lot of fun. So if you can, dear P4Pers, download, rent, stream Tony's movie. You can actually buy it. I bought it on Amazon. You can buy it as well. Sender, directed by Anthony Arkin, so that we can talk about it next week, but also so you can support Tony's film.
Would greatly appreciate it. Well, that would be super awesome. And you can just, if all you can do is watch the trailer, that's for free. You can see that.
But you won't see me. So.
Is that true?
I don't know.
I think you're in there. But make Maddie happy. Download that movie. Let's talk about it. I can't wait.
15 cents.
Michael's really excited. We can't wait for that. It's going to be really fun.
Awesome. Love it. Okay. Oh, and Amelia.
Well,
hits it out of the park in this movie too, which we will talk
about. Amelia is, she made this movie possible in many respects.
My God.
Delivers a hell of a terrifying performance that people that know her well would be probably surprised to see that she did.
My wife Colleen watched it with me and she turns, she goes, I can't believe you know her.
Can't believe Tony's married to her.
I know.
So scary.
It's so good. It's so good. All right.
I'm thrilled. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're @ratedparanormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram @kidriga or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
That's Tony's brother, and Elvis was part hybrid alien.
Give me a salt shaker of amphetamines.